a byproduct tobacco. From this material, we can build lumber that is lighter in weight and stronger than any wood you can buy. And we can do it cheaper than you can produce and fabricate a similar quantity from the forest. We can actually press this material into any desired shape or form. A piece of ground 10 miles long and 10 miles wide will produce 200,000 square feet of this synthetic lumber per day. When the war shut us off from tapioca, certain experiments were immediately started at Iowa State College. They found a waxy corn which produced the same kind of starch as tapioca. It produces a new type of starch. Here is a new industry awaiting development. Then we have some good white corn hybrid on the way. This should be of great interest to the cereal manufacturers. It is also possible that hemp in Iowa should make way for some interesting industrial development. The field of dehydration has an opportunity in the drying of alfalfa. The possibilities in plastics are endless. It is indeed a great honor and a rare privilege to pay tribute to the great agricultural achievements of the state of Iowa in this its first centennial year. The place which Iowa has attained in agriculture makes us immensely proud. Iowa will continue to lead the nation in agriculture in the days to come. In the very heart of the breadbasket of the world, we will continue to produce our share of the food and more for the needs of humanity and a starving world. The Almighty has richly blessed us by giving us the glorious sunshine and the refreshing rain which are needed in maturing our crops. The fields of waving grain and the green pastures of the Iowa landscape make a picture wonderful to behold. No wonder we are proud of Iowa. See yonder fields of tassel corn, Iowa in Iowa, where plenty filled her golden horn, Iowa in Iowa. See how her wondrous prairies shine through yonder sunset's purpling line. Oh, happy land, oh, land of mine, Iowa, oh, Iowa.
Mr. Speaker, I now yield to Mr. LeCount. Mr. Speaker, as we come to this centennial milestone of Iowa statehood, it is fitting that we look at her educational and religious achievements of the past 100 years. With their plows and axes, Iowa's early pioneers cultivated the soil that has since made her the greatest agricultural state in the Union. With the Bibles and school books they carried, these same pioneers planted other seeds that have won her a high place in the nation's educational and spiritual progress. Iowa's first children and all that followed in her 100 years of statehood were sent to both school and church. That is the big reason why Iowa has the lowest rate of illiteracy of any state in the Union. To Horace Mann, the great educator, goes much of the credit for Iowa's educational system. However, schools were started before the state was open for white settlers. The doors and windows were openings in the walls, covered with oil paper. Desks were planks fastened to the walls. Seats were benches. Textbooks were any books that pupils might find at home. Some free schools were established when the territorial legislature, at its first meeting in 1838, authorized county officers to form school districts. The plan required that a majority of the voters ask for a common school and support it with taxes. Some were too poor to pay these taxes, and so the early public schools were not well supported. Probably the most notable academy for higher education was the Denmark Academy, opened in 1845. Tipton opened the first high school in 1856. Free high school education was extended to all children by statute in 1911. Attendance soared, and the number of schools increased. Today, education is free until high school graduation for all persons between the ages of 5 and 21. It is compulsory between the ages of 7 and 16 years. Iowa is a state of colleges, and many of these have been children of the church. Just a century ago, in 1846, Grinnell College opened at Davenport as Iowa College. It was the first four-year college west of the Mississippi River. The state supports three institutions of higher learning: the State University at Iowa City, Iowa State College at Ames, and Iowa Teachers College at Cedar Falls. Iowa has a school for the blind and a school for the deaf. Private educational and correctional schools are well supported. Nearly all religious societies are represented in Iowa's population. The first church building, erected in 1834 at Dubuque, was Methodist. A log structure, it measured merely 20 feet square. One of the earliest churches, Old Zion, at Burlington, claims a colorful history. For 3 years, it served as the first capital of the territory of Iowa. Old Zion's bell still calls Methodists to worship in a newer building. From its small membership has grown the largest Protestant group in Iowa. The Roman Catholics are an even larger group. They were among the first white men to visit Iowa. Father Marquette led the first Christian service in Iowa at an Indian village in 1673. Today, one-fourth of the church membership of Iowa is Catholic. Asa Turner, a young man from the Yale Divinity School, established the first congregational church at Denmark. Soon after, the Hove Missionary Society sent 11 students from Andover Theological Seminary to open congregational and Presbyterian churches. The Little Brown Church in the Vale was built at Old Bradford in 1864, and the hymn about it has been sung in American churches for many years. The Lutherans have been sung in Iowa since the great migrations of Germans and Scandinavians between 1850 and 1900. Today, they hold third place in the state, outnumbered only by Catholics and Methodists. Baptists, Disciples of Christ, Universalists, Unitarians, Friends, Christian Scientists, Latter-day Saints, United Brethren, and those of the Jewish faith figure in Iowa's religious picture, as well as scores of other denominations. In the century of her statehood, Iowa has kept intact the spiritual and educational ideals of her forefathers: freedom of speech and press, freedom of religion, the right to work and save, and the peaceful pursuit of happiness. The humble and the proud, the poor and the rich, meet on common ground in Iowa. Yes, Iowa's men and women of the past 100 years have written glorious chapters in the Republic's history. The Iowa men and women of the next 100 years should contribute even greater glory to the nation and to the world. Let us, then, as Iowans, continue to emulate their shining example of devotion to the ideal good.
Mr. Speaker, I yield to Mr. Colley.
Mr. Speaker, it was customary practice in the 1830s and 1840s for steamers to set up banks in out-of-the-way places. Some of them were located in the deep forest and with a purpose. There, in some rude shed, a printing press was put to work to grind out pieces of paper which were never intended to be redeemed, which had no metal backing, and which bore no signature or stamp of a government official. There was a time when more than 7,000 different varieties of such currency were afloat in our country, and no one could be certain of its value, nor whether it had any value at all. Because these money printing shops were so securely hid away and sometimes vanished during the night, they were called wildcat banks. Obviously, the pioneer came to have little or no faith in these bits of paper. But even bad currency is somewhat better than none at all, and the metal money in circulation at the time was largely foreign coin. These became worn and were deliberately clipped, so that revaluation according to weight was necessary. Furthermore, since the coins, even though foreign, were better than the paper currency which circulated in so many varieties, Gresham's law, bad money drives out good, came into operation with the result that the metal money was hoarded. Sometimes, the so-called banker of that day would lend his printing press money and require the borrower to repay in metal, usually gold. Such a banker could establish himself in business for less than $100 and acquire for himself through his printing and lending operations hard money whose value was sure. These practices gave the banker a bad name, so bad in fact that the dictionary was exhausted in the process when men assembled to talk their troubles over at the Crossroads General Store. The General Store at the Crossroads was a remarkable place of business in the early days of our country, as indeed it was much later and still is in lesser degree. In addition to being a merchandise mart, it was a social center. I can recall when such a store carried stock that ranged all the way from calico, baby shoes, and strawberry pop, to neck yoke, whiffle trees, binder twine, and buggy whips, in addition to the groceries sold over the counter. The farmer would bring his eggs to this store where they were candles. That is, they were held up to the light of a candle, hid inside a cardboard box in which two holes the size of an egg had been cut to determine whether they were fresh. The grocer would trade his wares for them and give due bills for the difference between the value of the eggs and the value of the goods given in exchange. These due bills were used for later purchases. The farmer often found, too, that merchants in the nearby cities were willing to take these substitutes for money in payment for shoes, suits of clothes, and other merchandise. These city merchants would have them redeemed by the shipper, who bought eggs from the operator of the general store, and the latter in turn would accept them in payment for the next lot of eggs he delivered. Thus the cycle was complete, and no legal money was used by the country storekeeper or the farmer in this process. This general store often proved to be a profitable enterprise, and the operator lent his surplus cash to trustworthy customers. Not infrequently, this lending business, which at the start was wholly incidental to the general merchandise business, became so profitable that the operator either sold the store and engaged altogether in informal banking, or he let members of his family or a partner run the store while he spent his time at finance. Many illegitimate banks grew out of this kind of expansion, and the same is true of other businesses, like the land offices that were common institutions in the era when public lands were being sold as the great westward movement pushed the frontier line across the crowd.
Mr. Speaker, I yield to Mr. Dolliver.
Mr. Speaker, like every modern community, the state of Iowa has had many and variegated organizations based upon common economic or social interests. I have chosen to allude to three types only: labor organizations, business organizations, and veterans organizations. Because of the agricultural character of the state of Iowa and the dispersion of its population into many small communities, labor organizations have not attained the relative magnitude that they have reached in some parts of the United States.